Content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. We are in our second recording from the April 8, 2016 issue of The Week magazine, and this week we'll start on the Talking Points page. Four articles here. Sanders, the idealists who won't vote for Clinton. Bernie or bust. That's the defiant rallying cry of the Bernie Sanders hardcore, said Brad Brogan Morris in Salon.com. Polls find that up to 33% of the senator's supporters are insisting they'll refuse to vote for Hillary Clinton if she wins the Democratic nomination. That statement of single-minded devotion may seem naive, given that the Republican alternative may be a sub-Mussolini demagogue named Donald Trump. But the Sanders diehards aren't in the mood to compromise. Many helped sweep Barack Obama to power on a promise of hope and progressive change, and were disappointed. U.S. troops remain in Afghanistan. The criminals behind the financial crisis got big bailouts, and race relations have deteriorated. Clinton's coziness with Wall Street, her slippery ethics, and her hawkish foreign policy record embody rigged establishment politics. After falling for Bernie, his most enthusiastic fans refused to settle for the lesser of two evils. Sanders' absolutists seemed to think they'd be protected from the consequences of a Trump presidency, said Melissa Hillman in QZ.com. Does it matter to these privileged white college-educated purists that a misogynist, immigrant-bashing vulgarian would be empowered to command our military, veto bills, and nominate people to the Supreme Court, impacting life in the U.S. for decades to come? If you're black, Latino, Muslim, or poor, said Michael Tomosky in thedailybeast.com, the consequences of a Trump or Cruz presidency could be disastrous. Republicans would take a meat cleaver to the safety net for the poor, repeal Obamacare, shut down affirmative action programs, pass restrictive voting laws, and try to deport 12 million immigrants. Many Democrats will be voting to protect basic rights, not to make a symbolic statement of their purity. To win the general election, Clinton must reach out to those core Sanders supporters, and the senator himself, said Julian Zelizer in CNN.com. Sanders has inspired the Progressive Coalition, a passionate group that Democrats have too often ignored. Through her vice presidential pick and party platform, Clinton needs to make concrete appeals to his followers that are more than campaign rhetoric. That political reality alone makes Sanders' long-shot candidacy successful, said Paul Waldman in TheWeek.com. He set the agenda in the primaries, and if Clinton becomes president, she'll have no choice but to be keenly aware of the desires of her party's base. American Muslims, should police monitor them? When it comes to bigotry against Muslims, the Republican Party is now the Trump Party, said Jonathan Chait in nymag.com. After last week's terrorist atrocities in Brussels, GOP presidential frontrunner Donald Trump predictably renewed his call for a halt to all Muslim immigration. But Senator Ted Cruz, the putatively non-crazy candidate, went one better by pledging to empower law enforcement to patrol and secure Muslim neighborhoods before they become radicalized. Cruz's proposal is idiotic, said Peter Beinart in TheAtlantic.com. He cited a now-abandoned New York Police Department program that sent undercover cops into Muslim communities and designated entire mosques as terrorist enterprises. Yet police later admitted that scheme didn't yield a single terrorism investigation. American Muslims are far more integrated than Muslims in Europe, but that'll change if they're demonized. Cruz was not calling for a dragnet targeting all Muslims, said Andrew McCarthy, an advisor on Cruz's campaign in nationalreview.com. Politically correct liberals won't admit that some mosques and surrounding communities are now hotbeds of Islamic supremacism. Why shouldn't police focus their attention on them? Keeping tabs on Muslim communities today is no different from mafia-busting cops watching Italian neighborhoods in the 1980s, said David Marcus in TheFederalist.com. And the controversial NYPD program that monitored Muslims wasn't as useless as critics made out. Its findings were critical in identifying a bookstore in Brooklyn as a venue for radicalization, information that helped thwart a 2004 plot to bomb the Herald Square subway station. Cruz is simply backing a common-sense policy that recognizes the unique challenge terrorism presents. Treating all Muslims with suspicion is not common sense, said Michael Gerson in the Washington Post. Europe has a big problem with terrorism because its Muslim communities are so isolated and alienated. Most American Muslims are happy to be Americans and are often the first to recognize and report radicalization in their midst. Treating Muslims like dangerous aliens and occupying their neighborhoods with a heavy-handed presence would only breed resentment and lead credence to ISIS's claim that it's waging a religious war against the anti-Islamic West. Cruz and Trump would grant the terrorists a victory without a battle. Kasich, why is he still running? In politics, this truly is a year when the rules don't apply, said Rich Lowry in Politico.com. If they did, John Kasich would have long ago ended his delusional vanity project masquerading as a presidential campaign. In a year of angry voters, the Ohio governor has found little market for his moderate "can't we all get along" message. Kasich hasn't won anywhere other than his home state, finished at below 5% in seven states, and trails so far behind frontrunner Donald Trump and second-place Senator Ted Cruz that he cannot take the nomination even if he wins every remaining delegate. His plan is to force a contested convention and then somehow persuade the GOP to choose him over Trump and Cruz. At this point, a vote for Kasich is a vote for Trump, said Michael Barone in NationalReview.com. Many of the remaining 19 states select delegates winner-take-all statewide or by congressional district. With the opposition divided between Kasich and Cruz, Trump has an excellent chance of piling up lots of delegates in those contests, thus securing the majority he needs. Kasich's rationale for staying in the race is simple, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. In the upcoming primaries in the Northeast, he has a better chance than Cruz of stealing moderately conservative voters from Trump. With his doctrinaire, combative conservatism, Cruz is a turnoff to these mainstream Republicans. Plus, Kasich is the only remaining Republican candidate who consistently beats Democratic frontrunner Hillary Clinton in head-to-head poll matchups. If it comes to an open convention, why wouldn't the GOP nominate the candidate with the best chance of winning in November? Those arguments make no sense, said Jeffrey Anderson in TheFederalist.com. Kasich hasn't done well in the Northeast, and by diluting the vote, he's already cost Cruz possible victories in at least three states and could do the same in Wisconsin. Cruz has a much better chance of winning enough delegates to stop Trump's nomination if he faces him head-to-head. There's something very, very wrong with Kasich's entire strategy, said Jim Newell in Slate.com. His plan is to become the nominee by finishing a distant third and then having party leaders anoint him. If the will of the primary voters is that irrelevant, why bother hosting primaries? North Carolina, the culture war over bathrooms. Several days ago, North Carolina's General Assembly called an extraordinary special session, said David Graham in TheAtlantic.com. The reason wasn't a pressing budget crisis or a natural disaster. Instead, Republican legislators rushed back to the State House to overturn a local ordinance passed in Charlotte prohibiting discrimination against trans people. After Democrats walked out of the chamber in protest, Republicans unanimously passed a new bill, HB 2, that bars local governments from passing any non-discrimination ordinance covering the LGBT community and mandates that trans people in state schools use the bathroom aligned with the gender of their birth certificate. In other words, people in North Carolina can now be legally fired from their jobs or turned away at hotel chains for being gay. In the meantime, another 40 transgender bathroom bills are being considered in 16 states, and the Greensboro, North Carolina News and Record, making North Carolina the front line in a new culture war against LGBT rights. This was a bad day for our state. Apparently, keeping men out of the women's loo is now considered discriminatory, said Larry Thornberry in Spectator.org. Virtuous progressives would rather cater to the rare man who thinks he's a woman than the countless women who would rather not have to share their bathrooms, locker rooms, and showers with a person who has a penis, testicles, and a 5 o'clock shadow. Those of us with wives and daughters also are justifiably alarmed by the prospect. But for the cultural left, only the rights of carefully selected categories of people matter. Enough with the bathroom predator myth, said J. Brian Lauder in Slate.com. Social conservatives would have us believe that trans women are really men trying to get into women's room for nefarious purposes. But there hasn't been a single sexual assault of that kind in the 17 states and 225 cities that allow trans people to use the bathroom of their choice. Besides, how do North Carolina lawmakers expect to enforce their ban on trans women? By asking everybody to lift up their skirts or pull down their pants before entering the ladies' room? The American Civil Liberties Union has already filed a federal lawsuit challenging the dubious constitutionality of HB 2, said Mark Joseph Stern, also in Slate.com. If that lawsuit leads to federal courts establishing robust constitutional protection for trans people, North Carolina's bigotry will boomerang in a pretty stunning way. Here are a few short pieces from segments that we don't always get to. The first from It Wasn't All Bad. Jonathan the Giant Tortoise is feeling his freshest in 184 years. Hatched in 1832, the world's oldest living animal got his first ever bath last week in preparation for a British royal visit to his home on St. Helena, a British territory in the South Atlantic Ocean. Using a soft brush, loofah, and surgical soap, island vet Joe Hollins spent an hour scrubbing nearly two centuries' worth of grime from Jonathan's shell. He looked so much cleaner, and he seemed to enjoy the whole experience, Holland said. Hopefully he won't have to wait another 185 years before his next bath. On the boring but important section, the globe goes gray. America is aging rapidly, the U.S. Census Bureau reported this week, though not as fast as some countries in Asia and Europe. The number of Americans 65 and older is projected to jump from 48 million today to 88 million by 2050, when seniors will account for 22.1% of the U.S. population, up from the current 14.9%. Globally, the number of elderly people will double by mid-century, with some 1.6 billion people, or nearly 17%, 65 or older. Japan will retain its status as the world's oldest country, with 40% of its population over the age of 65 by 2050. Two-thirds of the world's seniors will be living in Asia by mid-century. The U.S. will drop from the 48th oldest nation today to a relatively youthful 85th place in the global rankings. And only in America, a Minnesota company called Ideal Conceal is releasing a handgun ingeniously designed to resemble a smartphone. The .380 caliber folding pistol can fire two bullets but remain virtually undetectable because it hides in plain sight. The company says the National Association of Police Organizations expressed concern over any kind of weapon that's designed so that it's not apparent that it is a weapon. Now we'll read our in-depth article, The Last Word, titled this week, The FBI's Secret Muslim Network. The FBI has built a pioneering outreach and informant network in Islamic communities around the country. These connections, say journalist Michael Hirsch, provide early warnings about possible radicals. Dearborn, Michigan may be the closest thing America has to a Molenbeek, the seething Islamicized neighborhood of Brussels believed to have harbored the terrorists involved in the attacks last month and in last fall's slaughter in Paris. An ordinary Detroit suburb, sometimes called the Arab capital of North America, Dearborn has the nation's largest mosque. It's home to the Arab Museum, Middle Eastern cafes, and halal beef burgers at McDonald's. It's also the target of right-wing fear-mongering and snarky Islamophobic commentaries, such as when the satirical Fox News correspondent Jesse Waters on Bill O'Reilly's show went to Dearborn last fall to ask residents, "Do you miss the desert?" Ron Haddad is Dearborn's chief of police, and he says he gets one question a lot when he travels around the country. "Someone will come up to me and put their finger in my face, and they're really angry," he says. They say, "Will the people in your community report acts of terror to you?" What he means is, will Muslims turn in other Muslims? Haddad has a ready answer. Not only would they do, he says. They've done it. Dearborn and Molenbeek, in fact, could not be more different, which says a lot about the very different ways that U.S. and countries like Belgium and France have approached the problem of radicalization. In a city where nearly a third of the approximately 95,000 residents are Arab American or of Arab descent, Haddad's department has a deep network of contacts in the community and makes regular visits to Dearborn's 38 schools and its many mosques. He sponsors a program called Stepping Up, which includes its annual award ceremony. The next is April 12th for residents reporting crime. At least twice in the past several years, fearing influence from ISIS or online propaganda on their children, Haddad says, Muslim fathers have turned in their own sons. In another case, it was students at a largely Muslim high school calling about a troubled peer. That's partly because they have a place to call and because they're connected to the larger Dearborn and American community, says Haddad. The outreach and informant program he runs is considered a model by U.S. law enforcement and counterterrorism authorities. And it's just one piece of a little-known but nationwide effort to build networks within Muslim communities. Few Americans are aware it's even happening. Certainly Bill O'Reilly doesn't appear to be. In the wake of the Brussels suicide attacks, Muslim communities have been a huge topic of concern. In the American presidential race, anti-Muslim sentiment is once again a convenient talking point, and it's not just Donald Trump. The GOP frontrunner is out there trumpeting, "I told you," about his proposed ban on Muslims. Trump's closest rival, Ted Cruz, has weighed in as well, saying, "We need to empower law enforcement to patrol and secure Muslim neighborhoods before they become radicalized." All this has distressed U.S. law enforcement officials actually involved in the counterterror effort. In fact, they say U.S. Muslim communities already are highly wired by U.S. law enforcement and intelligence. And contrary to being radicalized, they have proved astonishingly cooperative on the whole. Numerous sources in U.S. law enforcement and national security interviewed for this story drew a picture of a largely sub rosa but widespread effort in American counterterrorism. The deep embedding of federal counterterrorism and intelligence gathering efforts in Muslim communities like Dearborn. The FBI has been great, says Haddad, using an approach less driven by patrolling and surveillance than by sophisticated, if sometimes intrusive, outreach and informant programs. The result, U.S. officials say, is that Muslim neighborhoods here are cooperating against Islamist terrorists to a degree that can't be found among their counterparts in Europe. This past week, the biggest of these federal programs came fully online. An interagency task force run out of the Department of Homeland Security that for the first time will funnel into one place money and authority that has been allocated to different agencies like the FBI and DHS. As part of that program, the FBI is setting up what goes by the somewhat Orwellian name of shared responsibility committees. These groups attempt to institutionalize the entrenchment of federal law enforcement in U.S. cities, bringing together officials from the FBI and local law agencies, mental health, school, and other city programs, social workers, and imams and other religious leaders to come up with intervention strategies and to bring suspicious behavior to the FBI's attention. We're beta-ing it, says a senior law enforcement official. The whole premise is to professionalize a process that has been ad hoc for a long time. Authorities say the point isn't to set suspects up. Instead, it's to get closer to the source of alienation and off-ramp young people drawn by ISIS's propaganda, bringing them back to society with therapy and counseling before it's too late. Social workers and therapists will have access to classified information, and the shared responsibility committees will discuss whether there is clear criminal intent or whether alternative mitigation that doesn't involve a long jail term might be more appropriate. But, of course, the effect of the program will also be to cement in place the FBI's informant network. Plenty of these programs have been controversial, and FBI officials won't even say which cities have been chosen for the beta communities. In New York, Bill de Blasio canceled a controversial New York Police Department profiling program that the ACLU contended put just about every Muslim male under suspicion. One of the FBI's chief tools for heading off potential terrorists, aggressive sting operations, looks to many people like old-fashioned entrapment. A 2014 study by Human Rights Watch and Columbia Law School's Human Rights Institute found that, in some cases, the FBI may have created terrorists out of law-abiding individuals by conducting sting operations that facilitated or invented the target's willingness to act. In the case of the Newburgh Four, four Muslim men from upstate New York who were lured into a plot and arrested by the FBI in 2009, a judge said the government came up with the crime, provided the means, and removed all relevant obstacles, and had, in the process, made a terrorist of a man whose buffoonery is positively Shakespearean in scope. Law enforcement officials defend these programs as effective, despite the rare success of lone wolf-style attacks like the San Bernardino and the Boston Marathon bombings of 2013. Experts say that more aggressive community outreach might have detected both Saeed Rizwan Farouk, the San Bernardino shooter who had a pile of weapons in his apartment, and Tamerlan Tsarnaev, who a full 3 years before the Boston attacks began acting out his radical rage in full view of his local mosque. DHS and the Justice Department have also been consulting for years with Muslim community organizers, such as Hadi Miramadi, a lawyer based in Montgomery County, Maryland, who generally supports the government's outreach efforts and believes they could go even further in frankly confronting the Islamist sources of radicalization. Whatever its outreach, the U.S. approach to Muslim communities is overall more nuanced than what is going on in France, where police are surveilling thousands of Muslims who may have nothing to do with terror plots. And many observers believe the nuance goes a long way toward answering one big question looming over the issue of homegrown Islamic terrorism. Given that the United States has long been a main target of jihadi ire, why isn't there a homegrown terror problem in the U.S. like there is in Europe? There are a few obvious reasons. Europe is attached by land to Syria and other terrorist havens, while the U.S. isn't. For the most part, since the early days of Al-Qaeda, terrorists have sought to strike U.S. military or embassy targets abroad, rather than hit America at home. But most experts agree that part of the explanation lies in American Muslim communities themselves. Compared with the alienated Muslim underclass in France or Belgium, often composed of disaffected Algerian or Moroccan youth, American Muslims are far more assimilated and patriotic. And U.S. authorities say that, to a degree that the GOP candidates don't acknowledge, U.S. Muslims have been enormously helpful in the interdiction of plots. I can say unequivocally that in 10-plus years of my work in the federal government, Arab, Muslim, and South Asian communities across the country have become one of the greatest resources of protecting homeland security and promoting American values at the same time, says George Salim, the DHS official who is taking charge of the new task force. Jessica Stern of Harvard, another expert who has spent years studying radicalization, says one problem for ISIS recruiters in America, where fewer than one-tenth as many Muslims have sought to join ISIS abroad as have in many Western European countries, is that American Muslims are just too happy. Polling shows that American Muslims are patriotic. They are significantly happier with the direction of the country than non-Muslims. When kids get seduced by the idea of joining jihadi groups, their parents are often desperate to stop them. Stern adds that the relative prosperity and assimilation of American Muslims stands in stark contrast to that of Muslims living in Europe. European Muslim youth tend to see themselves as victims of prejudice in the workplace and in society. Muslims in Europe are far more likely to be unemployed and to receive lower pay for the same work than native Europeans. A number of cases in the past several years illustrate situations in the United States that could have grown into Brussels-style subway bombing attacks but did not. Law enforcement sources say that in 2010, Farouk Ahmed, a naturalized Pakistani from Loudoun County in Northern Virginia, who was accused of conspiring to blow up Metro Rail stations, was turned in by another member of his mosque. In 2014, the FBI was alerted by a local informant of plans by three Muslim teens to join ISIS in Syria. Former FBI Director William Webster told Politico magazine that the Bureau's prowess at outreach comes from its hostage rescue training over decades, the idea that honey works better than vinegar in the end. It's much more effective to make friends with people than to torture them, he says. But as ever, the threat is evolving. John Cohen, who is in charge of the DHS's program Countering Violent Extremism and now teaches at Rutgers University, says that the ISIS threat has become so diffuse and web-based that there's no longer a point to focusing on Muslim communities, at least in the United States. What we are finding now is that would-be terrorists don't simply reside in Muslim communities, and they don't always come from a Muslim background, says Cohen. We're finding it's troubled people drawn to the life meaning that comes from being associated with a cause. Their understanding of Islam is scarce. For Haddad of Dearborn and other U.S. law enforcement officials, the fear is that a new wave of openly Islamophobic politics could resurrect the radicalization they have worked to neutralize. So far, their efforts seem to be working. Charles Kurtzman, a sociologist at the University of North Carolina, says that even the relatively small numbers of Muslims in the United States who have been attracted to the Islamic State's ideology has been declining recently. The number seeking to travel overseas, presumably to join the Islamic State, ticked up between mid-2014 and mid-2015, and then dropped dramatically in the second half of 2015, he says. One possible reason is that the appeal of the Islamic State waned in the face of the images of violence and brutality. The political rhetoric, Haddad said, is more frustrating for the community than for me. I feel bad for the community. Those kinds of things are hard to ignore when they're all over the 24-hour cable networks. People are very misinformed. This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in Politico magazine. On the obituary page, the comedian who broke TV's fourth wall, Gary Shandling, 1949 to 2016. At the height of his fame in the 1990s, Gary Shandling was offered $5 million to host his own late-night talk show on NBC. The comedian turned down the network, preferring to continue making his own parody of the format, HBO's The Larry Sanders Show. Shandling's Sanders was the host of a fictional show within the show who interviewed real celebrities, including Sharon Stone and Robin Williams. But the series was more concerned with what happened when the cameras were off. Shandling showed famous guests bickering in dressing rooms and staff struggling to appease the egotistical and anxiety-ridden Sanders. "Everyone wants to be famous," Shandling said. "They think being famous will change their life. I'm here to tell them it doesn't." Raised in Tucson by shopkeeper parents, Shandling studied electrical engineering and marketing at the University of Arizona before moving to Hollywood in 1973, said the Washington Post. He wrote ad copy and sold sitcom scripts, but decided to focus on stand-up after a 1977 near-fatal car accident led him to reassess his life. In March 1981, he reached what at the time was considered a milestone in any comedian's career. An appearance on The Tonight Show, starring Johnny Carson, said the New York Times. Shandling became a regular guest host and in 1986 created It's Gary Shandling Show for Showtime. The series, which ran for four seasons, adhered to and mocked sitcom conventions. Playing a comic actor called Gary Shandling, the comedian often addressed the audience directly, breaking the fourth wall between performers and audience. "We're the TV generation," Shandling said in 1988. "So come on. We know it's a show. We're not fooling anybody anymore." Shandling's second critically acclaimed series, The Larry Sanders Show, which aired from 1992 to 1998, would inspire other cynical inside show business comedies such as Curb Your Enthusiasm, 30 Rock, and Extras. His career stalled in later years, and TV roles grew scarce, said the Los Angeles Times. Shandling most recently appeared with Jerry Seinfeld on Seinfeld's web series, Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee. In it, the pair chatted about death. "What I want at my funeral is an actual boxing referee to do a count," Shandling said. "And at five, just wave it off and say, he's not getting up." The author who told Wild American Tales, Jim Harrison, 1937 to 2016. Jim Harrison captured the soul of rural America in all its beauty and brutality. The author, poet, outdoorsman, and bon vivant, most famous for his 1979 novella collection, Legends of the Fall, made into a hit 1994 film with Brad Pitt, set his stories in America's wild corners, the big sky country of Montana, Nebraska's sandhills, and northern Michigan's forests, where he spent his summers hunting, drinking, cooking, and writing. Harrison said he needed the wilderness. Early in his career, he had tried teaching at the State University of New York, alongside literary luminaries like Alfred Kazin and Philip Roth, but soon returned to his native Michigan. "It was an exciting place," Harrison said of the university. I enjoy intelligent company, you know, but I like outside better than inside, and there weren't enough places for me to feel free. Born in Grayling, Michigan, Harrison was 7 when a neighborhood girl ended a quarrel by thrusting a bottle into his face, permanently blinding his left eye, said the New York Times. For years afterward, he sought solace alone in the woods and took refuge in fiction, especially the works of William Faulkner. Harrison studied literature at Michigan State University, and after his brief spell of teaching in the 1960s, took up writing full-time. His first three novels, Wolf, 1971, A Good Day to Die, 1973, and Farmer, 1976, were well-reviewed but sold few copies, and Harrison found himself so broke he couldn't pay his taxes. His turnaround came when he discovered the journals of his wife's great-grandfather, a mining engineer, and was inspired to write Legends of the Fall, about three Montana brothers who fall in love with the same woman. Harrison, who published more than 30 books, often found himself compared to Ernest Hemingway, said The Guardian. The two writers shared a love of the outdoors, wrote stories for and about men, and had an enormous appetite. Harrison once ate 144 oysters just to see if he could. But Harrison rejected the comparison. His writing was more lyrical and his characters far less self-assured. I'm always having a man in desperate straits trying to help somebody else, with no apparent success, he said in 1980, because nobody can be helped by anybody. On the adjoining page here, we've got a business column we'll read. Issue of the week. Apple matures into middle age. The world's most valuable company is beginning to show its age, said Bob O'Donnell in Recode.net. As Apple marked its 40th birthday on April 1st, there were plenty of milestones to celebrate, not least the fact that more than 1 billion of its devices are now in active use around the globe. But there are signs that the company's youthful vigor is starting to fade. Last week, Apple held an uncharacteristically short and subdued launch event to unveil its new 4-inch iPhone SE and 9.7-inch iPad Pro. These smaller, cheaper versions of existing Apple devices look like solid products, but no one will mistake them for major innovations. Instead, both devices look like the result of careful corporate planning and analysis, built to fill very specific market niches. And while that's not what we're accustomed to expect from the inventor of the iPod and the iPhone, it's exactly what you'd expect from an adult company. When did Apple become so boring, asked Mike Murphy in QZ.com. Once upon a time, we could count on Apple to announce some big new thing at a slick press conference every year. But apart from the Apple Watch, the company's first entirely new product in 5 years, Apple's recent innovations have been derivative. Apple products in every size and shape you can think of. The devices add incremental improvements like better battery life and camera quality, but not much else. Consider that sometime in the next year or so, Apple is expected to unveil the iPhone 7, Apple Watch 2, MacBook 2, and iPad Pro 2. Like a Hollywood studio endlessly cranking out superhero movies, Apple appears locked into an unending cycle of sequels and spinoffs. There was one big surprise at Apple's launch event, said Don Reisinger in Fortune.com. The $399 price tag for the iPhone SE, a bargain by Apple standards. The company clearly hopes the cheaper device will be popular among consumers in developing countries who have gravitated toward cheaper phones running the Google Android operating system. A hit device overseas could help reverse slumping iPhone sales, which are expected to decline this year for the first time since the device debuted in 2007. The future, however, probably belongs to a tech giant that can move past the smartphone era, says Eric Achard in Reuters.com. Many experts believe we've already reached the practical limits of what we can squeeze inside of the devices. What's coming is more smartphone-like technology, including Siri-like personal assistants, being embedded in everything from cars to fridges to watches and jewelry. Cut Apple some slack, says Christina Warren in Mashable.com. The company has had a lot more on its mind lately than new products. CEO Tim Cook used last week's event to address weightier matters. First and foremost, Apple's battle with the FBI over encryption. That fight may be over now, but the debate will rage on long after the public forgets about the newest features in the 4-inch iPhone. Privacy, security, and public policy may not be the most exciting fodder for Apple geeks, but it almost seemed as if the company were saying, there are things more important than new gadgets. So no, the products Apple launched last week weren't that interesting, but the circumstances in which they were launched sure were. We're going to flip back and pick up a few columns from the international page. Pakistan. Christians targeted by the Taliban. The heart of Lahore and its children were attacked this week, said Luvat Zaid in Dawn. On Easter Sunday, a suicide bomber detonated a vest loaded with explosives and ball bearings at a playground in Gulshan-e-Ilbal Park, which was crowded with Christian families celebrating the holiday and mingling with their Muslim neighbors. Children and parents were ripped apart as they lined up for a merry-go-round and picnicked on the grass. A Taliban splinter group claimed responsibility for the atrocity, the deadliest since the murder of nearly 150 people at a Peshawar army school in 2014, saying it had targeted Pakistani Christians. But most of the 70 people who died in the attack were Muslims, and at least 29 were children. Authorities responded by cracking down on suspected jihadists, arresting more than 200 people across Punjab province. The city of Lahore itself chose compassion. Thousands of people streamed to hospitals to donate blood and bring food and flowers to the wounded. Muslims and Christians mourned together. This tragedy is the result of our criminal neglect of our duty as Muslims to protect Pakistani Christians, said Mosharif Zaidi in the News International. Our 3 million Christians are an intrinsic part of our country. Wealthy Muslims send their kids to Christian private schools. Muslim doctors turn to Christian nurses for assistance. Yet this is the third terrorist attack in 3 years specifically targeting Christians. Last year, also in Lahore, two churches were bombed, killing 15 people. In 2013, suicide bombers attacked a church in Peshawar, killing 127. Why weren't Punjabi authorities patrolling the Easter celebration? It is not surprising that Punjab was targeted, said The Nation in an editorial. Extremism has been growing across the region. Just last week, Islamic groups banded together to oppose Punjab's new law creating women's shelters and a hotline for battered women. They call the measure un-Islamic. The same day as the Lahore bombing, Islamabad was besieged by 10,000 supporters of Mumtaz Qadri, the assassin who in 2011 shot dead Punjab's moderate governor, Tama Salman Taseer. The governor's sin was to speak out against the execution of a Punjabi Christian woman for blasphemy. Qadri was executed last month, and his supporters now want him declared a martyr and all clerics serving sentences for terrorism released. Such demands are beyond ridiculous. The nation does not have the patience anymore amid death and fear to sympathize with those who defend murderers. We need to stop our youth being brainwashed in extremist madrasas, said the Daily Times. Millions of children are exposed to unfiltered, hateful demagoguery that warps their attitudes toward non-Muslims in a harmful way. That they should be incited against Christians is horrifying, as Christians have a special status in Islam as people of the book. These Islamic schools must be dismantled and reformed, or else Pakistan will continue to witness the glorification of religiously motivated violence. From Canada, continuing to break up native families. Canada is repeating our old pattern of injustice against Indigenous women, said Carol Finlay. In the last century, Indigenous children were ripped from their tribes and warehoused in residential schools, causing damage that reverberated down the generations. Violence, substance abuse, and crime are now endemic in the children and grandchildren of the people placed in those institutions. And how have authorities responded to that crisis? By incarcerating Native women, far from their communities and at shocking rates. Across Canada, more than two-thirds of female federal inmates are Indigenous. In Edmonton, the rate is more than 90%. This is again devastating Indigenous families, because when a woman goes to prison, she is often the sole support to her family, and her children go to foster care. The loss of her kids sends her into a spiral of hopelessness and depression. Cut off from their families and culture, and locked up in a white man's justice system, these women become mentally and physically ill. When they get out of prison, they are broken, and they have no job training, so they can't earn money to get their children back. If we don't break this cycle, we become complicit in the ongoing tragedy of the residential schools. And from Russia, not quite all Putin had hoped. President Vladimir Putin's military adventure in Syria has boosted Russia's global influence, but it hasn't delivered everything he wanted, said Vladimir Frolov. Russia's air power has indeed changed the trajectory of the war and allowed our ally Syrian President Bashar al-Assad to consolidate control over most of western Syria. And the Syrian ceasefire deal agreed to by the U.S. and Russia in February perfectly reflects Moscow's traditional vision for such settlements, the two superpowers dictating terms to their proxies. But Putin had hoped to achieve so much more from his intervention. His real goal was to revive the bipolar format of Russian-U.S. cooperation and rivalry for influence that existed during the Cold War, and that mission remains incomplete. The U.S., for example, shows no inclination to solve the war in Ukraine or any other conflict through bilateral talks with Russia. Nor will the U.S. view Russia as an equal until the Kremlin stops seeing everything as a zero-sum game in which a win for the U.S. must be a loss for Russia. Right now, Russia has been gaining leverage by making itself first part of the problem and then magnanimously removing itself again. A bilateral world won't come about unless Russia is willing to start joining, developing solutions. On the health and science page, recovering memories lost to Alzheimer's. Neuroscientists have long believed that Alzheimer's disease destroys the brain's ability to store memories, wiping away all trace of the people, events, and knowledge that make up the fabric of a person's life. But a new study suggests that memories lost to the progressive neurological disorder aren't gone forever, but merely rendered inaccessible. Researchers at MIT put two groups of mice, one healthy and the other genetically engineered to have Alzheimer's-like symptoms, inside a box and gave them mild shocks to the feet. When mice in the control group were later placed back inside the box, they displayed fear, a sign that they recalled the trauma of the shock. But the ones with Alzheimer's seemed unfazed, suggesting they had forgotten the experience. After pinpointing the brain cells associated with short-term memory, the researchers stimulated the forgetful mice with high-frequency bursts of light. Known as optogenetics, the technique effectively restored the animals' memories by prompting their brain cells to grow small buds called dendritic spines, key components of neural circuitry that connect with other cells and allow the transmission of information. After the treatment, the mice once again feared the box. The findings could lead to new Alzheimer's treatments that target compromised recall mechanisms in the brain, an entirely new approach to the disease. Even if a memory seems to be gone, it is still there, study author Susumu Togawaha tells the Washington Post. It's a matter of how we retrieve it. Australia's coral bleaching crisis. Ocean warming and acidification have triggered an epic bleaching event in northern Australia, leaving huge swaths of coral devoid of color and struggling to survive. This is the worst coral bleaching event ever to hit this most pristine part of the Great Barrier Reef, said World Wildlife Fund spokesman Richard Leck. When coral is stressed by changes in temperature and acidity, it expels the symbiotic algae living in its tissue that provide it with essential nutrients. This causes brilliantly colored reefs to turn bone white. A resilient reef can recover or adapt if conditions return to normal or stabilize. But if temperatures rise too quickly or algae loss is prolonged, coral eventually dies. Ocean temperatures in northern Australia have averaged 1.8 degrees Fahrenheit above normal since January. But it's more than a localized crisis. Climate change and a strong El Nino have been heating seas all around the world, posing a threat to coral reefs almost everywhere. Marine ecologist Nick Graham of Lancaster University in England says the current bleaching event compares to the most severe on record, which wiped out 16% of the world's reefs from 1997 to 98. This is the big one that we've been waiting for, he tells The Guardian. But Graham believes the situation isn't hopeless. The real question mark is how frequent these events are going to be. If it's another 18 to 20 years until we get the next one, then a lot of reefs will have time to bounce back. Healthy heart, sharp mind. Americans are constantly advised to lead a heart-healthy life, and for good reason. Heart disease remains the leading cause of death in the U.S., but cardiovascular health is also a boon to the brain, new research reveals. The study examined the habits and lifestyles of more than 1,000 people who were an average age of 72. Specifically, they assessed how many of the American Heart Association's goals the participants achieved: keeping physically active, maintaining a healthy weight, and eating regimen, not smoking, and keeping blood pressure, cholesterol, and blood sugar levels under control. The participants also completed cognitive tests when the study began and again 6 years later. As it turned out, people who more closely adhered to a heart-healthy lifestyle showed fewer signs of age-related mental decline, reports TechTimes.com. University of Miami neurologist Hannah Gardner, who led the study, suggests more research is needed to pinpoint the age ranges during which cardiovascular-friendly behaviors may influence cognitive performance and mitigate decline. Here's a brief from the It Must Be True, I Read It in the Tabloid section. A California baby born with an immaculately coiffed full head of hair like Elvis Presley's has become an internet star after her mom shared a selfie online. When Mackenzie Kaplan, 28, posted a photo on Facebook of herself cuddling up with Isabel, thousands of social media users likened Isabel's thick brown hair to Elvis, as well as to Charles Bronson's and Mark Wahlberg's. Others were simply jealous of her perfectly styled hairdo. "How does this baby have more hair than me?" wrote one commenter. "I thought babies were bald." And some other short notes. To reach the 2,383 delegates needed to win the nomination, Bernie Sanders now needs to win 66% of the remaining delegates. Hillary Clinton must win 34%. This delegate count includes the 469 superdelegates who have pledged to support Clinton. President Obama has thus far granted just 70 pardons, the lowest mark for any full-term president since John Adams in 1801, and 187 commutations of sentence. Meanwhile, 1,629 pardon petitions have been denied, as well as 8,123 requests for a commutation. The Secret Service has denied a petition signed by at least 51,000 people to allow the open carry of firearms inside the Republican National Convention in July. The petition, which may have been started by a liberal activist to embarrass Republicans, says the no-guns policy in Quicken Loans Arena in Cleveland is a direct affront to the Second Amendment and puts all attendees at risk. 82% of GOP House members, 90% of GOP senators, and 69% of GOP governors haven't endorsed any of the three remaining Republican presidential candidates. On the poll watch, 45% of Americans agree with Ted Cruz's proposal that we need to empower law enforcement to patrol and secure Muslim neighborhoods before they radicalize. 40% disagree. 74% of Republicans agree with Cruz's statement, 57% of Democrats, and 37% of independents disagree. And we'll finish with a quote from Robert Mitchum. There just isn't pleasing some people. The trick is to stop trying. Well, we've run out of time for today's Reading of the Week magazine. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This program is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments? Give us a call, 919-832-5133.